You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you, Flora, as always. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's good to see you all for the last 18 years. So we got a little special treat for you right now. This is going to be a little bit of footage, uncut footage from the new Deep Space Nine documentary, and it may end up in the DVD when it comes out, or it may not. So, but you were the first people to ever see this, so this is pretty exciting. So stay tuned.
Is tomorrow's duty roster for your approval?
Lieutenant?
Benjamin Sisko, sir. I've been on temporary assignment here. Before I leave, I just want to say it's been an honor serving with you, sir.
Trials and Tribulations was magic and technology that had never been done before. We're making history in television.
Congratulations. How do you feel?
I got it.
I believe he said he had to go pee.
Forrest Gump was sort of something we had talked about, just conceptually. The key was, you said, we could put ourselves in one of their episodes. It wasn't just go back in time and construct a new narrative.
Who's talking about mine?
I don't know, sir.
Gary Hudson came up to the art department and kind of explained what he had in mind. He said, we want to shoot the proof of concept shot. He said, oh, nobody has that. Turns out that weekend there was a start to mention last night. So the went, and we bought a red shirt.
I said, well, I just wanted to show you something.
He hit play. Plays the clip. There's a scene on the bridge. It was like, Kirk walks into the bridge. And they kind of looked at us. He's like, what do you think? I'm like, it's fine. It's good. No, the security guy standing next to the turbo lift, he's not
not really there. And then we went, what? Ran it back. And clearly he was like one of the visual effects guys in like a Star Trek outfit. And we were blown away because it was that seamless even at that pass.
Gary showed me a ton of visuals. We just sat there, he goes, we're gonna use this, we're gonna use this, we're gonna use this, and here's the script. Now you gotta figure out this in-between stuff, how you're gonna put it all together.
How the hell did you get that episode? Direct.
That's what I was just gonna ask you. You're the one that came to me and said, Jonathan, I decided that I'd like to give you this episode.
That's how he did it, ladies and gentlemen. That was the trick question. I wanted to see if he was gonna fall for it, and he did not. Jonathan Tribulations was such a show with like every spotlight on it.
People would come down to the stage, you know, like some of the writers would come down, and they would just be like little kids. They'd peek around.
That was like so much
fun. That was
fun.
Too much fun.
No,
that was
people getting. That was like a strange week. I was hurting a bunch of like 8-year-olds. It's like, no, you gotta do the activities that, you know, we have to keep the show moving.
It was so much fun.
I get to be, and then I get to be one of those Klingons. I wasn't going to miss that party.
Everybody enjoyed doing it. Everybody had a great time on the show. I am getting to be dressed up in the period of time when it was my favorite show on the planet.
And Terry was in the bridge, and she was looking over to Kirk when he sat on the Tribble. That was preconceived. We knew the shot we were using with Mr. Shatner, and we stuck Terry on a green screen. We lined it up with a video camera. We had a playback, so we had a video assist. We were able to show the original, and we were able to see where Terry fit in the frame. She walked a few steps, and then down some steps, and out. And then the visual effects people moved her in the frame as the dolly had her. So it's just a matter of looking at the monitor and making sure physically it could work, and she did pieces.
Beh, bellissimo, allora abbiamo avuto questa anteprima mondiale, perché ripeto che non è stato mai mostrato prima, avrete riconosciuto sicuramente tutti l'episodio di DS9 che poi è stato nominato ai premi Hugo, che io ho avuto l'onore di tradurre tra l'altro in italiano per il doppiaggio italiano, e quindi siamo qui per festeggiare il 25esimo anniversario di una serie straordinaria che molti considerano probabilmente la migliore serie tra quelle dell'universo di Star Trek, e quindi vi vorrei presentare prima di tutto, la conoscete quasi tutti, Lolita Fagio. Per quei pochi che non la conoscono, Lolita ha lavorato in Star Trek per 13 anni, è stata la coordinatrice delle sceneggiature e aveva un compito estremamente importante, che era fondamentalmente quello di garantire la continuity, cioè in poche parole, per i non addetti diciamo ai lavori, era la persona che doveva assicurarsi che ogni script, ogni episodio che arrivava, ogni sceneggiatura, non fosse in contrasto con quello che era stato fatto prima nell'universo di Star Trek. Questo era il suo compito fondamentale, quindi coordinatrice delle sceneggiature. Poi dopo è passata anche in post-produzione. Quest'anno, come avrete notato, non abbiamo un attore in DIPCON, è stata una scelta che abbiamo fatto e siamo molto contenti di averlo fatto, perché Lolita ha parlato della possibilità di avere qui Ara Stevenberg e David Zappone, che sono rispettivamente il regista e il produttore di questo documentario, ma come penso tutti voi saprete non fa assolutamente molte convention, quindi è veramente una chicca averla qui, ed è diciamo il signor Deep Space Nine, il nostro ospite d'onore. Prima di tutto quindi vorrei invitare a salire sul palco il produttore di questo documentario, David Zappone. Che, come potete intuire dal cognome, è di origine italiana. E, E poi sono veramente, io so che questa convention è sempre stata molto particolare perché qui è sempre interessato molto quello che succedeva dietro le quinte, quindi la sceneggiatura, la regia, il make-up eccetera, e sono emozionata e sono veramente onorata e felice di avere qui con noi lo showrunner di Deep Space Nine, Miss Ira Steven Behr.
We have to share. Okay. You're
good at that, though, right?
Yeah, we share a lot.
We can do that.
Here. Agua. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
So, usually when we do this, we just start talking and talk for a while, and then we ask if anyone has questions, but there's usually a lot more people, and they usually understand. You want some too? Yeah. They usually understand what we're saying, and in this case, we're not sure.
They will understand what you're saying.
Yes.
So it might just be better if we just open it up to questions. We have a couple of more clips from the doc. Again, these are clips that no one else has seen, and as far as we know, as of today, will not be in the doc. Even though we cut them as individual segments, but we have so much footage and so many things to get to fit in 2 hours of film.
And we have over 100 hours of interviews to try to cut into 2 hours, so you can imagine how difficult.
So things we thought would definitely be in the finished film are not going to be in it, but we thought they're kind of interesting still, and they'll be on the DVDs or the Blu-rays anyway, so we thought we'd share them with you tonight. But before we show the second clip, I think we should just open it to
some questions.
Yeah, about the doc,
honestly,
about Deep Space Nine.
No, honestly, I think that
everybody
speak and talk, yes. I think they're more interested in that than then later the questions, really.
All right, well, I'll start.
You start.
They want to know about you guys.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think I asked Ira to do this documentary back in 2012. And we're now coming up on 6 years of this. This is going to surpass his time on the show. We did 7 years on the series. We're now looking to surpass that. So I think Ira hates me is the short answer.
Well,
but,
yeah. When I said yes back in August of 2012, I thought this was going to be a quick little 1 hour documentary. I'd interview some of the actors who were in Las Vegas at the time at the Vegas convention, and then we'd have some fun.
And we had some fun interviewing you for we interviewed Ira for our Shatner documentaries, Get a Life and Captains. So Ira and I developed kind of a friendship, I would say.
Yeah, and Chaos.
And Chaos, right. Chaos and the Bridge, thank you.
The TNG doc.
Yep.
So I just thought when Dave came up to me at the convention and said, hey, do you want to do this doc and you could interview everyone? And I didn't really think much about it. I just said, yes, I was having a good time. I thought it was going to be easy. 6 years later, I can't believe that we're still working on it. But a lot of that has to do with the fans and maybe even some of you. Who contributed to the Indiegogo campaign, because once that happened,
it
suddenly became a much more important doc to us. We realized we could not just give you the same old interviews with the actors. We really had to work on getting them to speak and talk about things they don't normally talk about at every convention appearance. We just started to come up with different ideas. We filmed the writers getting back together for a day to break episode one of a mythical season 8 of Deep Space Nine, and that was a fun day with everyone together, so that's intercut within the doc. And just little segments that we just got excited about. We interviewed a ton of fans. Fans sent in their little testimonials to the show from all over the globe, and we've used as many of those as we can. And it's just become a, a feature film. Somehow it's become a feature film, but it's because of the fans. It's all of you that's kept us doing this.
Well, what happened was when we had raised the original money ourselves and kept this project going for all these years, and I was told by the various networks that, well, Deep Space Nine is kind of the middle brother and people don't really care about it. So I said, I don't believe that. I've been a fan since 1993. I've loved the show ever since. And I convinced Ira, reluctantly, to try Indiegogo, to try crowdfunding, to really gauge how engaged the fan base itself was. And they recommended that we set a goal of $150,000. And we hit that in a day.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know.
And then we ended up at much more than that. And it is a testament to Deep Space Nine that we were able to do that. And no one believed it but us. Actually, maybe not even us.
I asked you, I said, are we going to make $150,000 in 30 days?
Yeah.
And you said, well,
I hope so.
I hope so. So yeah. I thought, oh my God, this will be quite embarrassing if we don't make the money. And then 29 hours later, I got a call saying we had $157,000.
How many people have donated? You have a final count on that?
At least 10,000.
Wow.
We're over 10. I believe we have surpassed the number of donors that we had for The Love of Spock. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Leonard Nimoy documentary that I produced.
Yes.
And that was the same situation. You know, that one was shocking, quite frankly, just to digress a bit. Here's Leonard Nimoy, a cultural icon, and the networks and the studios are telling me no one's interested in him.
Oh.
I'm like, really? And so I convinced, to his credit, Adam Nimoy, Leonard's son, to try crowdfunding. The family was against it, everybody was against it, and we ended up setting a record on Kickstarter, and it enabled us to make the movie that we wanted to make. Because otherwise, the Spock documentary would have been Star Trek clips. That's it.
Yeah.
So we were able to delve deeper into Leonard's life. So, anyway.
So it just shows the fans want this
stuff. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I've had very good luck with the fans. Yeah.
And the other thing we're doing is that we came up with also because of the fans, because of the response, we said, what can we give the fans? And I've been saying for years, you know, I've lived in hope of a Blu-ray of the show because I've never been happy even when they came out in the late 90s, the DVDs. I didn't like them back then, especially the seasons 1, 2, and 3. I thought they looked muddy. They were not very well done. So I've been, you know, hoping that they'll put out a Blu-ray. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, but we thought we'd up-res some footage, so the doc will have footage of Deep Space Nine and Blu-ray, and let me tell you,
it's amazing.
It's an amazing difference. You know, I thought I was pretty jaded and blasé about, you know, how good can it look? How really different can it look? It looks very different. It looks brand new. And I don't know if you can see coffee stains on the uniforms like you can see on
I think
Spock's.
You guys were more careful
I
by
think
then.
We were more careful of Avery Brooks did not really allow food on the set. So hopefully that won't happen. But it's a good looking film.
And,
so.
And CBS is really looking to this documentary to see the success of it to move forward on the HD for the Blu-ray. So we're pulling.
So yes, no pressure on any of you,
but
the more that you support and buy, the
spread
more
the word,
CBS
please.
Will go, hey.
Can I say one thing? Yeah.
You can say two
because
things.
Because I was, okay, one and two. I was a little shocked by what you said, because here in Italy, most of the fans think that Deep Space Nine is the best of the series.
We know that.
But did they think that in 1999? Did they think that when the show was on? I mean, when the show was on.
Really? Always.
Yes.
Always.
Always.
That's interesting. I don't think
I mean, it has the best scripts. It has the best cast.
Yeah.
You know, and the best stories. That's
well, I can tell you as an American, that was not the consensus in America.
I know, that's why I'm telling you. Here in Italy, it has always been like that.
Well, that's
so,
good to hear.
Yes.
Every time we've ever had a DS9 actor here or anywhere over in Europe, it's been a huge hit to have those actors.
Well, so that's good to know. I mean, it's great to know, but I think in a way the fact that we were kind of overlooked at the time gave us a freedom to do what we wanted that was not quite the same old for the franchise, and the fact that, you know, we convinced ourselves, even though it wasn't true, that no one was watching, that the only ones who cared about the show were ourselves. So it enabled us to just go all the way with the kind of storytelling we wanted to do. And even though Paramount would get upset at times, you know, I think it was probably best for the show that we felt like we were the forgotten sibling.
Flora, why do you think it was the most? What is your reason for that?
Well, first of all, I work on it.
Yeah. Okay.
On the Italian dubbing. No, I think. personally, I'm very fond of the original series, of course. Okay. I love The Next Generation. I like Voyager, even if I work on it. But I think Deep Space Nine has really a depth that the other series don't have. I mean, even if it's based, you know, on a station, which was supposed to be a static show, let's say, I think, you know, the development of the character, the interaction of the character, the quality of the writing, and I'm not saying that because Ira is here, but I'm really a huge fan of his writing. And, you know, also the Dominion. It was really, really well constructed. I'm speaking as a fan, of course. I'm not in the business. I'm in the Italian business, maybe a little bit. But then the script, I think, are the most important things. The interaction and the development of the character during the seven years. If you think, for example, at Dr. Bashir, at the beginning, he's just basically almost a child.
Well, Sid says he threw like a girl. That's what Sid says. That's not me.
But then, you know, and then the cast was wonderful. I mean, many of the actors had a theatrical background, yes. And I think it shows. Many of the characters which were regular, there were even main character, but regular. I'm thinking about, you know, Andrew Robinson, for example. The recurring character, like Andrew Robinson. I'm thinking about, you know, some scenes between Bashir and Garak, for example, or, you know, it was an amazing cast, I think. It was an amazing cast, and I think that when you have... And, you know, I've always been, as a fan, more interested in the writing and the stories than in special effects, which were amazing anyway. But for me, you know, I always say, if you ask me which is my favorite episode of the whole Star Trek saga... I will always say City on the Edge of Forever by Harlan Ellison, because I think that he was an excellent science fiction writer. I think the script was really good. They even made William Shatner act in a good way.
No comment.
But, you know, I've always looked... What I look into science fiction for me as a fan, I look in stories. I look in stories that are believable, even if it's science fiction. Sure. I look in the development of the characters. I need something. You know what I mean? I don't like, you know, big special effects and that's it. No, there has to be a story. And Deep Space Nine has such a wonderful development, I think, during the years. And... you know, I'm talking, so I just want... I have one question that I think it's more than 10 years that I wanted to tell you that. I always thought of another ending for Deep Space Nine, and I'm curious to hear what Ira would think about that. What would you think if the last scene would have been... help me, please. What was the name of Sisko's character when he was the writer?
Benny Russell.
Thank you. What do you think if the last scene would have been Benny Russell taking out a sheet of paper that he was writing and Deep Space Nine would have been his novel?
Well, I did have the idea, the way I wanted to end
really?
The show
wow.
was I went to Rick Berman and I said, okay, here's how we're going to end the show. Forget about the Dominion War. That all would have ended. Everything would have ended. But then what we were going to have was we were going to have, actually I can't remember now if it was Benny or if it was Cisco. I think it was probably Benny. But we were going to have him literally having a nervous breakdown and wandering off the set and into the soundstage and show it to be all a TV show based on his writings.
This was my idea.
And Rick Berman looked at me and said, okay, but does that mean a Voyager came out of Benny Russell's head? Does that mean the original series came out of Benny Russell's head?
That's what I thought.
Mean TNG came out of Benny Russell's head? It's the Star Trek franchise. You keep forgetting that it says Star Trek Deep Space Nine, not just Deep Space Nine, to which I said, well, let's take off Star Trek and let's just have Deep Space Nine and end it with Benny Russell. And that was never going to happen. It never even got to the studio. I can't imagine what the studio would have said if we came to them with that idea. But that was my initial take.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that because I thought it was, I mean, I realized, of course, that it could never been possible because of the reason you just said, because it's a franchise. And, you know, you would have all these other problems with all the other series. But I'm amazed that you really had... No, I mean, I'm amazed that I had your idea. That's what I mean.
Well, it shows that you know more than you think you do.
And, yes. And, you know, from my point, my personal point of view, I really could appreciate the quality of the writing and the quality of the acting, because believe me, in dubbing, when you dub a series into another language, if you have a script which has some flaws, and you know that some have big flaws, and sometimes in dubbing we try to correct them, and when you have actors that are not able to act and that maybe are not able to say a whole sentence, you know, and that's it. And they always say, that's awful for dubbing. And I can tell you that translating was a little bit difficult because you have the techno bubble and everything, but the quality of the script and the quality of the acting made dubbing much easier, much easier. So, you know, when you translate a script, you go into it, you go deep into it because you have to, and then you adapt, of course. You have to really try to give the same sensation into your language. So I, in a way, I studied the script. I just not watched the episodes. And I was really, you know, amazed, mesmerized by the quality of it. And I think that from the friends I have here, not only here, but I mean in Italy, I can tell you that if you ask 10 trackers, probably... Nine out of 10 will tell you that Deep Space Nine is their favorite Trek series. So I'm amazed that it was not in the United States.
It's good to know, I guess. You know, I'd rather have them love it now rather than have it loved back then and say that the show, you know, hasn't aged well. I'd rather have them say that it's aged well, like myself.
Exactly. So, like all of us.
Like all of us, yes, well, of course, like all of us. Shall we show the second clip?
Yeah, let's go to another
one. Again, same thing. It's not going to be in the film, but it's an interesting little finish. Should we get out of the way?
I think we're good. We are anyway.
Tell us if we're not.
We can stay.
We can stay?
Yes.
Is there an episode that stands out as brutally tough?
Oh, by far, Ross and Scholes.
That's the episode where it looked like it was filmed, but the makeup kept running into their eyes.
I made sure almost today that I was going to play a general almost today, because I knew it was going to be hot. So I wanted to be with my boys. Then I can judge when to get out of the sun and when not to.
I remember watching the weather projections for that week continue to do this. And it was beyond the point of no return for us. Go out there.
I remember desert heat. I went, oh my God, it's going to be tough 2 days.
I had a brand new pair of shoes that the rubber soles on the shoes were literally melted.
We had 17 Jemadar stuff. And it's a full Hebrew suit with a complete latex pullover head and rubber kitchen gloves that were painted to look like scales. So they were completely ensconced in rubber in 128 degrees. We were up on the side of the cliff, the first team being Colin and Mr. B with their guns aiming at the Jemadar who were probably a quarter of a mile away down at the bottom. We had 3 vans that were air conditioned that we sent in to get the Jemadar down there. We'd get them in position and then the vans would pull out. And just about that time I'd get the first team in and get ready to roll, one of the Jemadar would pass out.
The medic was looking at all the Jemadar because we were dropping my box. And the medic didn't know who I was. He just came up to me and looked at my box and goes, I'm taking you out of the makeup. I go, no, no, no. And he goes, yes, I am. I'm telling the stunt coordinator, I remember slicing the gem in our head and taking water bottles and going, boom, boom, boom.
We cut a hole and we would pour ice water and it would run down the inside of their outfit and that's how we were trying to keep them cool down. That was 3 days from now.
The dailies on that show were pretty incredible. I mean, it's true, all the actors, their eyes were red from the makeup running into their eyes. We were getting production calls saying, you know, someone's gonna be going to the hospital, it's so hot. Which is why we were a show that almost spent the full 7 years on sound stages. We didn't go out too often because it was very difficult to shoot outside. We had to find something that did not look like contemporary, 20th century landscapes. And that usually meant would be someplace deserted, hot, and tough to shoot in. And this was a perfect example for that. So, yeah, good times.
None of the besides the original series, none of our shows really went on location very often. Like you say, it was too difficult, first of all, and just too hot. Except for the baseball episode.
Yes.
Which is probably one of my favorite episodes of all time.
Yeah, that was...
It was still hot, but it was manageable.
Yeah, we lucked out. I mean, we had all these grandiose visions. This was Take Me Out to the Hollis Suite.
Yes.
We had these grandiose visions of renting out Dodger Stadium. No way. Not in a million years. But we found a college ballpark, and we did, the movie magic. We had very, very few extras sitting in the stands, but we were able to move them around, much like in Gladiator, as Gizmo was saying to me before. Actually, it's the only time ever that I ever took an episode that I had written for a previous TV series and decided to remake it. I had done an episode called The Old Ball Game on Fame, which was very difficult to shoot with all these dancers trying to play baseball. Very difficult indeed. Plus, we were shooting it in Culver City, and I told the director, all I ask is, you see beyond the field, don't show the palm trees. Because we're supposed to be in New York City. So don't shoot the palm trees. They're all the way in the background. You have all these other angles. Don't shoot the palm trees. If you ever see the episode, you'll see the palm trees in the back of it. So I thought, it had a lot of fun, and it was a basic thing about the underdogs, winning over a superior, force. Which is kind of like what we do on Deep Space a lot of times. So I thought we'll do it again, change it around, do some of the same gags. I wasn't going to write it again. That would have been too much of a cannibalization. So we had Ron write it, and that was a fun show. But that was very contained, and that was difficult too. Don't get me wrong. Not everyone could play ball, and plus it's very tedious shooting sports. You have to Someone has to be able to hit the ball exactly to where we want, the director wants the ball to be hit. Then who's ever on the other end? The fielder has to be able to make the play, you know, if we need them to make the play or not make the play and miss the ball, but in a way that you believe it while you're watching it, that they actually try to catch it. Anyway, it was, it's another reason not to go out too often. That's, you do that once, and that's enough in 7 years.
But it was one of the last shows before the Dominion War arc, right? Wasn't it right before?
Yeah, that was
led up to it.
That was one of the things. At the time, I think I actually said, okay, this is going to be the last fun episode we do. And then later on, we came up with Bada Bing, and I said, okay, we're going to take time out from the Dominion War, because those shows were also very expensive. Not that Bada Bing was inexpensive, but that was another example of trying to find some fun amidst the chaos and destruction and bloodshed of the war.
Does anybody have any questions? This might be a good time.
Yes.
Sir.
So you touched around the war and everything, two things that are extremely important. One is the relationship with religion, the Bajorans and the war, this one topic. And the other is the social issue. You mentioned the Far Beyond the Stars episodes and the two back before when they go back in time. So how because this, especially now in Italy, that we are discovering ourselves as being racist, how these things came into being and solidified all over the arc of the 17th sequence?
You know, I don't want to take too much credit for doing socially relevant shows on Star Trek. I mean, the original series, you know, did that as well. I always thought those were kind of the easier kind of shows to do because the point of view is a shared point of view by most of the people who are making the show, and most of the people who are watching the show, I think, fit in that same kind of political category. Though as time has gone on, I have discovered Star Trek fans are a lot more conservative than I expected them to be on social issues. But for the majority, let's say, past tense came about very simply. I was down in Santa Monica, which is a beach in LA. You know, it's a beach community, and there was this beautiful grassy little strip of pedestrian walkway overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And I was down there, and there were all these homeless people lying in the grass, like resting, or one of them was sleeping on a sleeping bag. And all these tourists and all these people are there taking pictures of the Pacific Ocean and literally like stepping over these homeless people like they were sculpture, like they were not real, like they were made of stone. And it really kind of hit me that day. And then, so I went back and we came up with this idea. And while we were filming it, there was an article in the LA Times saying that they were thinking about putting homeless people into these neighborhoods that would just be for them. You know, and they would be kind of, we thought of them as camps, you know, get them out of sight, get them away, and then keep them in there for whatever. And that's how that came about. Far Beyond the Stars was a writer came in and pitched us a show about Jake and these thinking he's a writer in the 1950s, and these aliens, turns out these aliens are watching. It's one of those Star Trek episodes where aliens are trying to figure out how we interact as humans. And I said, no, we passed on that story. And about a day later, I was driving home to my lovely wife there in the audience, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I love the idea of 50s science fiction writers. We could have the cast out of makeup, but I didn't like the idea of aliens looking in on us. And that's how the idea of a African-American writer who, I knew stories about women who had to take initials so that they'd hide their names in real life to get published in the 40s and 50s, or have names that sounded like male names. And I just thought, you know, this would be a good story to tell. I went back the next day to the writing staff and said, you know, the show I said we're not going to do, we're going to do it, but it's just going to be totally different than what Mark Zakri had pitched. So that those were easy. And religion came about because the studio told us no more shows about politics. They told us to stop shows about Bajoran politics. They're boring. The audience doesn't want them. They did market research. I said, well, I know something about market research. I worked in market research. And if you do a questionnaire and you say to someone, what would you rather see? Space battles, you know, or shows with war, or shows with Klingons, or love stories, or whatever. And then what about politics? Well, no one's going to say, yes, I say number one is politics. So obviously, but they were very adamant about it. This was at the end of season one. They said, no more politics. And so I went to the writing staff and said, okay. I talked to Michael Piller about it, and we said, okay, let's do religion. Because, you know, Gene was not big on religion, and I thought it would be something. I didn't think of it as religion. I thought of it as faith. Yeah. Faith. Yeah. You know, faith is the important thing to me. Doesn't matter. Faith is with everyone. You can make up your religion and make up your gods however you want to make them up, but faith is important to human beings. And they never once complained. They never once came to us and said, stop with all the goddamn religion. Never. It's weird. I still don't understand why. In fact, in the documentary, I talked to Kerry McCluggage, who is the chairman of Paramount TV at the time. He couldn't tell me why. He didn't really. It just was better than politics, I guess.
I don't know. Those are two touchy subjects, though. Religion and politics.
Yes, but of course science fiction makes them less touchy because you put people with funny noses or with funny hair or something and suddenly it's not as dangerous. You're not, you know, playing with the here and now.
Anybody else have a question? Comment? Yes, Kieran.
Kieran McGrady, Bristol Post.
Gee, that's not the question I told you to ask us. Yeah. Jesus,
so
stay
much for
on
having
script.
A chill in the
audience. What our expectations were? Well,
much lower.
Much lower. We had no expectations. Yeah. I mean, they had done an Indiegogo.
Yeah, and it was.
I had never
difficult.
Thought about it.
I mean, the Spock Indiegogo was difficult in that the Kickstarter, you have to set your goal and reach it by the end. So we set a goal of 600,000, and it was actually difficult to reach. We spent the whole month getting there. And this Indiegogo, I got to give this guy, Mark Hofstadter, I got to give him a lot of credit. He told me that's a mistake. It's too high a goal. Set it lower. People are more excited when they blow through it quicker. And then it becomes, how much more can we raise? How much more can we raise? And that's what happened. We, as Ira said, 29 hours we hit the $150,000 goal. So he proved to be 100% right.
Yeah, these guys have gotten me all kind of like worried. I kept saying to Dave, as
I was worried,
I kept saying, are you sure we're going to make this money? Because I really don't want to do this if we fail. How is it going to look if we fail in 30 days, in a month? Not to make the money. And he goes, well, I don't, we should. We should.
We got to give some props to Lolita and to you for writing the pitch and for the actors.
Yes.
Stepping up. Everybody stepped up. So it became not just, well, if we get this money, we're going to go get the actors. The actors actually participated in the Indiegogo.
And I think that's a real testimonial to the days that we live in with the social media.
Yeah.
Because
they were
everybody was out there. Yeah.
Yeah, all the actors were so supportive of us and tweeted and again, participated on camera. I mean, it couldn't have been better.
Now, so. Is it right that all the people that donated will get a credit on that?
Yeah, there's a certain amount, I think, a minimum amount. But yeah, we have like 6,000
wow.
names, six of the 10.
So you can imagine at the end of the documentary, it's going to be a long credit roll.
Well, no, yeah. That's the problem. We have to include
at least 6,000
that in the running time. It really is difficult because so much of your film is taken up by these long credits, and we are busy as we speak coming up with things that we can do to make those credits entertaining because the film doesn't end until the film ends. So we're going to have 10 minutes, 11 minutes, I don't know how long it's going to take, of these credits, and I refuse to just have them play over nothing. So we're going to have to find ways to liven it up a little bit and have some fun with it. Plus, we also want to credit all the fans,
people that are in the body of the film,
who we interviewed. Yeah. And that's a new one. That's people who, you know, we want their names and we want a picture of them so that you can identify who they were. Mm-hmm. It's a tedious thing to do, but it's only fair because, again, this film exists in the way it will ultimately exist because of the fans. So we want to give them as many props as possible.
Flora has a question.
Yes. I'm very curious about one thing, Ara. The rules of acquisition. Did you really invented them all? I mean, some of them are so real in real life.
No, I invented them. Yeah, I came up with most of them. Robert Wolf and I came up with a lot of them that were in the book. But that all, again, that's all serendipity. That's not something I planned on doing. It's mentioned briefly in the doc, in a way, by David Livingston, who was the supervising producer. What happened is David Livingston, who was the supervising producer of the show at the time, came in and pitched an idea, which was not a very good idea, you know, but it was about gangsters, basically, you know, or it was a meeting of these different cultures who were meeting on Deep Space Nine to go over some kind of trade agreement. I don't know what that was. And we were trying to figure out, because he was supervising producer, so we wanted to give him a story credit. You know, we wanted to pay him for a story, but it had to be a good one. So Michael Piller in the room said, why don't we do The Godfather? You know, and make it like five crime families. But I have to tell you, that wasn't going to work either, ultimately, to actually write it. Because in the room, as David said, he said, Ira, you'll write it. And it's like, I'll write it, because I like movies. And he figured, you'll do The Godfather. But it meant coming up with five new races, not like the Dominion, but for one episode. And who would they be, and what would they look like, and how would they sound, and all that stuff. And so in my panic, I said, let's make it a Ferengi episode. Little did I know that that was going to change my Star Trek life. Not because of history, but my Star Trek life, because suddenly I had to write this show, and I came up with this idea of the Negus as Michael's godfather. And I remember looking in a dictionary to come up, you know, a good name, and it's based on an Indian word. There was a Negus. I found it in the thesaurus.
I didn't know.
And then I remember sitting in my office, and I had to give them something that he believed in. And I remember the rules of something. And again, I was thinking, why would it be? And I looked it up, and I thought, acquisition sounds like a good term. Rules of acquisition, that sounds like a proper Ferengi term. And it was supposed to be one episode, you know?
It stuck.
You gave Max Gradenchik something to obsess about for the rest of his life. Which they all know. He's been here many times, reading out of that book.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank God for Max, and thank God for Armin. But Max really, you know, humanized the Ferengi and gave the audience someone to root for. Because I always said Ferengis were 20th century human beings. To me, the Ferengi besides Chief O'Brien. O'Brien and the Ferengis are the only humans, recognizable humans, on Deep Space Nine. Everyone else are a bunch of heroes and are too damn good for their own. They always do the right thing, and I don't believe in people who always do the right thing. I don't know anyone who always, except that guy. He does the right thing. But he's the only one. He's the only one.
You need something.
And my wife is giving me a look, so maybe maybe she does the right thing most of the time. But he's the only one who does it all the time. So, you know, so I thought the Ferengi, you know, turned out to... because I remember, and this is the last thing I'll say on Ferengis, but I remember, and it's in the doc me telling Rick, I remember when Mike Piller told me that there was going to be a Ferengi on the show, this is before the script that had even been written for the pilot, I said, don't do it. I thought the Ferengis were awful. I had written one which Max played on TNG, Rice. When I was on TNG, and I just didn't see Ferengi, the good of Ferengi, for anything at the time.
Wow.
And I said, why do you need a Ferengi? What? And they, and Michael was convinced they could rehabilitate the Ferengi. And little did I know that he was right.
He was right. God bless.
And that him. I would be partly responsible for it. So there you go. Hear that, kids? Never say no to a Ferengi idea. You don't know what idea is going to be the one that's going to hit. So when someone comes up to you and says, I got this crazy idea, and you go, get the f*** out of here, don't do it, because you never know. You never know what people are going to like. We have another clip.
Yeah, I was just going to say clip, we have a last clip.
This clip, as you'll see, I was down on the set for this one. I actually was there when it happened, and it was the final day. It was the final day, or no, it was the day before. It was the last week.
Last day in the cave.
The last days in the cave, and something happened that wasn't supposed to happen.
Dennis Madelon, go away now.
Dennis. BC, go away.
Go away.
Yeah, first of all, this was like the last day of Deep Space Nine, and we had a miraculous stunt 7 years. Pretty proud of our safety, just keeping everyone safe, safe, safe. Adrian Brooks is one of the handiest guys I've ever worked with for 7 years. He's just a great fighter.
Now, Adrian's got to tell you another story. He's wrong. I'm standing on a step. He's below me, and I'm supposed to have this superpower. Basically, I told him,
you know, we worked on a routine, he just threw it back in, it was about that far away from his face, and everything was as cool as ever.
He could be a foot away, and it would still look like the end. So in rehearsal, he just goes, and do the line of dialogue, okay? So they say, action. Wham! And I snap my face right here. I went down like a ton of brick. No! No! That is
might have moved off of Marty's attention. That's just enough to get hit, you know?
He says I stepped into it. I was on a step. I couldn't step into it.
I was on the set for that, by the way.
Were you really?
Yeah, the three of you going down, it was just amazing that for that moment I happened to be there.
Bam!
I didn't, from the angle I was at, I was standing behind neighbors, so I couldn't see exactly what was
happening.
I heard a bang, and I was told that you weren't going to come back.
I went to the hospital as the cop didn't move my face. Oh, God. All the nurses and doctors were like, who is this?
But you did come back, right?
Of course.
I had an amazing thing. But you did come back, right?
Of course.
I had an amazing thing. Yeah, so
that's not going into the final talk.
No, that's not going in either. And so I was, you know, I was there when it happened. I didn't quite see, I was standing, I was behind Avery, so I didn't, but the sound was kind of surprising. I mean, the contact was very loud, and
Avery's a big man.
And Alimo Mark was not happy and said some things I can't repeat here. But I was told that, you know, he wasn't coming back, that his nose was busted and he wasn't returning. And I guess it was the last day. I guess we then went into Vic's to film the final scenes. And I was freaking out because it was like, it's not that easy to keep the show going after the show has wrapped forever, you know. But he came back. He came back. The nose turned out not to be broken, but he did have two black eyes, and it was. I got to give Alimo credit for coming back, and how it happened and what the real story is, I have no idea. You know, Avery, look, he was really upset. So I know it was an accident, but whether he leaned in or Avery accidentally got too close,
but
we'll never know.
I got to say, you got to see the documentary just to see Alimo, to see the kind of guy he really is. He's a riot. That's all I'll say.
Yes. And on that note,
there's only one Alimo.
There's only one Alimo.
Mark Alimo is a riot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In one way or the other.
Yeah.
Unique person.
Mm-hmm. I'll say this. I'd like to know what you guys think about this. When the show was on the air, the most popular character of all the supporting people, without a doubt, was Mark Alimo as Gul Dukat. He got the most fan mail that was sent to the office. Fans were always talking about Dukat. They were writing fan fiction about Dukat, where he was, you know, he was a mixture of Marcello Mastroianni and Cary Grant, and it was very weird, the stuff they would write about that character. And to me, he was a Nazi, you know. To us, he was a Nazi, and Mark hated to be called a Nazi.
I don't see Marcello Mastroianni in him. Not as
well. I don't see him as one of the most beloved.
No.
I'm telling you. Ah. I'm just telling you what the fans were.
And what Mark saw.
But now, without a doubt, the most popular character on the show in 2018, who's not one of the top eight regular characters, is Garrick, is Andy Robinson.
Of course.
Without a doubt.
Ira, I can only tell you one thing. We had Andrew Robinson.
17 years ago.
We never had Mark Alimo. There must be a reason for that.
I know there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think it's something, again, that's very positive for the show and actually for the fans, because to me, it always bothered me. Yes, Alimo was great. He did. Dukat was a fantastic character.
Yes.
And he did have levels, but he was, you know, it's like the women who marry serial killers. It's like, you know, it's like he's still the villain, and he's an out and out villain. Even if he loves his daughter, he could love his daughter and still be a villain. But Garrick is mystery. Garrick is enigma. Garrick is, we don't know. Andy Robinson could not tell you the truth about Garrick. I could not tell you the truth. Pete Fields, who created him the first time, could not tell you the truth about Garrick. And I think it's good that fans today appreciate that and find that interesting and don't necessarily want answers. They just like the question so much. They find that fascinating. And I think that's very healthy and a very good sign for the longevity of this series. There you go.
I completely agree. And another character that I think that I loved was Morn.
Morn? Yes.
All of his lines. You liked him, Tully said.
We were going to get Mark Shepard to sit down for an interview, but it just seemed wrong.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to break that mystique.
Yes.
We don't want to break that mystique this late in the game. But, no, come on. I only said one question. What?
You could have asked him a question and then cut it.
That's, That's true. We could have done that. And maybe we will.
Oh.
We're good. Yeah.
Time.
And we're going to have an autograph.
Vi ricordo che adesso faremo una sessione autografi per chi non ci sarà domani. Altrimenti rimandiamo a domani che siamo tutti stanchi. Oh, sorry. We're going to have an autograph session, but people who are staying in the hotel and leaving tomorrow, we would prefer to have the autographs, the photo autographs tomorrow, so we can go and have dinner.
So we can go eat.
Oh,
the picture is okay.
See.
Yeah. Oh, tomorrow too. You're staying here, right?
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine, because I always saw that it was considered the best track show in the United States. Okay, which shows that, you know, in some things we Europeans are definitely superior. Okay.
no argument here. That's
okay,
true.
Then I really like to thank you, wonderful Lolita, as always, for giving us the opportunity of having here both David and Ira, which for many of us is really an icon. And thank you so much for showing us the documentary. I know you're not used to having few people like this at a convention.
It's fine. It's
but, fine. But believe us when we say that we really love and appreciate what you did, and we're looking forward to look at this documentary. So thank you very much.
Well, we love you all back. Let's hear it from the audio visual guys.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
Couldn't have done it without these two guys.
You did a good job.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Allarme rosso, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 è pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 è posizionato.
Thank you.
energia terrificante.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.